So when it comes to this parak, so something that we raised over the first couple of days, and really come to conclusion, and that is, why is it that Paro believed Yosef, or understood Yosef's dream, rather and not the dreams of not the interpretations that are brought before him? I mean, others interpreted it. Paro said, no, that can't be, that can't be. And then he used Yosef's dream, he heard Yosef's interpretation, said, oh, that must be right. So, came across someplace online, quoting from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that the Rebbe answered the question, that Yosef answered the question that was puzzling. Nobody was able to answer the following idea, that Yosef, that Paro mentioned, in Paro's dream, remember we made a point of this, that the skinny cows came out and stood next to the healthy cows. And then the next pasuk says, and then the skinny cows devoured the healthy cows. So claim says the Rebbe, that's what confounded everybody. Meaning things are either good or they're bad. How could something be both? That there was a moment in time when things could be both good and bad. So all of the interpretations that were given that we've seen, that the other Chartumim gave, that there are going to be seven babies that are going to be born, then they're going to die. There are seven countries that you were going to conquer, and then they're going to be destroyed. So there was never a point that was both good and bad at the same time. And that was the point that that Yosef was able to solve. So I came across an article on the Har Tzion website where Rabbi Grossman points out that there's a very good reason why nobody interpreted that aspect of the dream of the skinny cow and the fat cow standing next to each other, and that is because in Paro's retelling of the dream, he left that part out. That part's not in the dream. If you look in the beginning in Perek, again, on verse 3, it says, Pasuk Gimel, and they stood next to the paros on the Sfas Hayor, on the bank of the river. However, later on, when Paro tells over the dream, in Pasuk Yutes and Pasuk Chaf 19 and 20, never saw anyone such bad, and they ate the bad cows, ate the good cows. And then the Paro actually adds in a section in the next part where he adds in and he says, and the skinny cows look the same as they did before they ate the bad cows, the fat cows, as they did after they ate the fat cows. So it's a little disingenuous to just simply say, oh, well, they didn't explain that part. No, it's much more than that. Not only did Yosef understand that aspect of the dream, but he was able to intuit that part of the dream. How was Yosef able to intuit that part of the dream? Well, Yosef simply said to Paro, it's not me that's coming up with these explanations, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu coming up with these explanations. So Paro said, aha, I'm going to believe him, because he was able to figure out a part of the dream that I didn't even say to anybody. Right? I think in Daniel. In Daniel, when we learned Daniel in the shul, when we learned the book of Daniel, so that's how Daniel rises to power. Daniel's rise to power is because he was able to come and interpret the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar. So not only did he interpret parts of the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar, but he interpreted parts of Nebuchadnezzar's dream that he didn't reveal to anybody else. And that's how Nebuchadnezzar began to trust Daniel. But beyond that,
Interesting. That's how they learn interrogation techniques. You interrogate people, you don't know, they'll tell everything.
You see that in the my only experience with interrogations is what I see in the movies. I don't know about anybody else in this room. But there, one of the classic things is that they reveal, the Mossad does this all the time, it's part of their routines, that they are able to figure out things that the guy says that they didn't tell him, if he's able to give more information, so they know what to do. How did he know? So his interpretation that was unique from the other ones is that there's going to be a period of both good and bad. That in the beginning aspects of the years of plenty.
Not at the same time.
No, there was times where it wasn't immediate that the famine overtook the years of plenty, there was going to be a time when they were going to be the same. You know, the food has to run out, right? So it's going to take a little bit of time. So the other interpretations that were given, the idea that you're going to have children, they're going to die, or the idea that you're going to have conquered countries and they're going to lose them. So they didn't have that dual aspect to it. So Yosef, because he had that dual aspect, so then he was able to be victorious. So beyond that, there's another point that Yosef differed in from everybody else, and that comment was made by the Tzivtzei Chachamim, that besides that there was overlap, the Chacham makes another point that had to do with things with Paro. They were specific things. Paro is going to have 7 children, and then they're going to die. And even the other one that we know of, that Paro, that they interpreted Paro's dream as you're going to conquer 7 nations and you're going to lose them. In the world of kingdoms of ancient history, that was a personal gain for the king. That was unique. Why did they conquer these more lands? So that the king could be enriched, not necessarily so that the people would be able to be enriched. In fact, there is in tomorrow's Navi Shir, in Beth HaMedrash, in Yoshua, a preview for those for some people here. So Yeshua has his first battle with people fighting on horses and chariots. He fought battles in Yericho, Ai, and then he fights battles in the south, and then he goes and fights battles in the north. So the pasuk says that the people that were attacking from the north actually had horses and chariots. And so not only was Yeshua victorious in that battle, but Yeshua also, when he conquered the horses, he was told by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you should hamstring the horses. You should, I assume that means you cut off their ligaments or something so that they're not going to be able to hop anymore. You're going to wound all of those horses. So he's told that explicitly, and the Gemara actually has talks about the laws of Tzar Balei Chaim, the causing affliction to animals, based on that pasuk. So Yeshua is told to do it, and then he goes ahead and does it. Now there is a pasuk in the beginning of Shmuel where it says that David traveled eastward, and David conquered lands in the east in the beginning of Shmuel Beis. He conquers those lands, and the pasuk tells us that when he went ahead and conquered those lands, he hamstrung all of the horses. Right? So why did he do such a thing? So the Rashi there explains that, well, he did that because there's a limit to how many horses a king is permitted to have. And David went, and David was already above that limit, 100 horses. So this was thousands of horses. So he was already above that limit, so therefore he did that. But wait a second. Why did when Yeshua did it, Yeshua was told to explicitly by Hashem. And in fact, probably the understanding of that is that you probably are not allowed to cause pain to horses. But because David was told to do it explicitly by Hashem, so therefore Yeshua was told to do it explicitly by Hashem, so there he went and did it. Why did David go ahead and why did David do that? So I came across the Sefer, whose name is eluding me right now. It's on Hebrew Books. And it was written by a Rebbe in Merkaz HaTorah. Forgetting the name right now. So he explains, well, it's pretty simple, that the battles were being fought differently. When Yeshua was conquering the land, we call that a Melchemes Mitzvah. We call it a Melchemes Mitzvah. He was told, you have to conquer the land. Right? That's a Melchemes Mitzvah. When David was traveling, was conquering lands to the east of Eretz Yisrael, so that is a Melchemes Rishus. So the lacha by a Melchemes Mitzvah is that the horses, not horses, but whatever spoils are won, they get divided up amongst the entire Jewish people, as you see in a couple of other stories in Yeshua. They divide up all the spoils. When it's a Melchemes HaRishus, all the spoils of a Melchemes HaRishus go to the king. So therefore, it's easy. We understand it well. By Yehoshua, those horses would have been divided amongst all the people. So Hashem told him, though, no, you can't divide amongst all the people. You got to hamstring them. Okay, but when David was doing it, that was going to be enriching the king. So if it's only going to be enriching the king, David had already reached his horse maximum. So because he couldn't go above the horse maximum, that stuff wasn't going to go to the people anyways. So therefore, he had to make them unusable.
The point, if you didn't have strength, the enemies could use it to fight him. What's the?
I don't know why. If he didn't, he would have used them for himself. I mean, the way was to avoid using them for himself. Why did he just kill them? I don't know. You gotta look in those psukim and Shmuel Beis, I believe Parak Ches. So, anyways, okay. So the dreams that were interpreted, the way the dreams were interpreted by the Chartumei Mitzrayim, that had to do with Paro himself. What Yosef intuited something that was going to be for the entire kingdom. And perhaps that's what Paro felt as well. Paro felt, I'm having a dream as a king. I'm not just having a dream as whatever his name was. I'm having a dream as Paro. And because I'm having a dream as Paro, so therefore it has to be something that affects the entire people. So I saw in my notes, it had a source attached to it, but I looked up that source and it wasn't there. So I'm not sure what the source is, but it's a nice idea anyways, that this is a very different understanding of what a king is.
Right.
That a king in the normal, in the regular world, or in the ancient world, and even in the modern world, a king is in a position to enrich themselves. And what is the purpose of all of the king's horses and all the king's men? The purpose is all to enrich the king. It's all to build up the status of the king. So Yosef saw, however, that no, that's not the way that the Torah understands a kingdom. The way the Torah understands a king is that the king is there for the people. The king is there as a person to give and to care and to worry about all the people. So that's why Yosef had a different understanding of the dream. Yosef could realize that it's not about Paro himself, it's about the entirety of the people that were there. And therefore Yosef gave an interpretation, not one that would only affect Paro, but one that would affect the entire country. I saw a couple of years ago one of the things I think that Gary Erlbaum sent out on his list was the reason why Americans have so much trouble with dealing with the Middle East. American presidents so much trouble with dealing with the Middle East is that it's a totally different mindset. A president of the United States, what is he looking for? Right, the president of the United States is looking to accomplish many things on behalf of his people, so that he will have a wonderful legacy and then be able to make a lot of money giving speeches at Goldman Sachs. Right, that's his goal. Right, and you hear that on the news all the time, that Obama is in search of his legacy, however he's going to be defined, however he's going to be remembered. He wants to be remembered as a good president as opposed to a bad president. You're not going to make that much money as being the president. You're not the president for life. It's about having that legacy, and
right.
For whatever motives a person has that they want the legacy, but either to just be remembered for good or to make money off of it, but it's all about how you're remembered for what you did for your people during your time in office. In the Middle East, where you have these leaders that are there for 25, 30, 35 years, so what's their goal? Their goal is to stay in power. Their goal is not to give all their people liberty. Their goal is not to make their subjects' lives better. Their goal is to keep power in for themselves and for their family. So for an American president to go and speak about, oh, this is going to be your way to make right with the world, and you're going to do well for the Iranian people and stuff, that's not what they're motivated by. They're motivated by keeping their own power, keeping their own control. So that is not just a modern phenomenon. That is a phenomenon that goes all the way back to the times of Paro. That generally kings were there to enrich themselves and not for the people. So the uniqueness of Yosef's addition and Yosef's interpretation to Paro was that it was more than just being a way of enriching him, but rather it was a way of helping out the entirety of the people. Yeah.
And one thing, and there's a classic article, and it's called Why Arabs Lose Wars. And the main thing that they push is that somebody, some officer, has some knowledge or the equipment nobody else has, and you won't share it.
Because
it's his power.
Okay.
And that's why they can never, in the anti-army, everybody gets more jobs, everybody...
Similar idea, right? It's a top to bottom.
They can never win a modern war.
Right.
Though they're a warrior, because they all control, they want to control, and then you can't do that.
Right. And one could probably make a case in the Israeli army, it's flipped.
Yeah, yeah.
That they give everybody a control, which,
right.
For better or for worse. Okay, hopefully for better. Right, so I mean, this Paro is the one leap that you have to make for that forward is that this Paro was different. That this Paro actually cared about his subjects, which is why he had the dream and wanted to.
Not only his subjects, but the country as a world power.
Right, and he was able to see as a future that could become a world power as a result. Yeah. Okay, so continue. So this idea of the Jewish perspective of the king is laid out in a beautiful essay from Rav Nevensal in Parsha Shoftim, when the mitzvah of giving a king is given. So there's really two parshios in Tanakh where it talks about the powers of a king. One of them it talks about in extremely positive ways, and one of them talks about in extremely negative ways. So the positive ways is found in parshas in Devarim, in Parshas Shoftim, Perek Yud Zayin, where it describes that a king that you should have a king. From among your brothers you will have a king. You can't have somebody from outside who's not one of your brothers. That's by the way where we get the idea that a ger can't be a king, and also a woman, the idea of a woman as rabbis actually comes from this pasuk. And then it gives all the negatives of a king. Right? You shouldn't have too many horses, you shouldn't have too many wives, they're going to lead you astray, and you shouldn't have too much money. Right? It's all not going to be about you enriching yourself. It's all going to be about the limit. This parsha is all about the limitations placed upon a king. So then we get to Shmuel Aleph, and the people come to Shmuel HaNavi. That's on page 1028. But in Shmuel Aleph, I think that's actually the Haftorah for Parsha Shoftim. The people come to check that. Oh, no, it's not. It's not the Parsha. The Haftorah for Parsha Shoftim is during the Sivan is in the weeks after Tisha B'Av. So it's not going to have to do with that. But in Shmuel, they come to. I think it might be a different Haftorah though. But they come to Shmuel and they say, "We want a king." And how does Shmuel respond to them? "Oh, you guys don't want a king. You know what a king's going to do? A king's going to take away your daughters. A king's going to take away your sons. He's going to make them go fight in wars. And he's going to do all these different things that you don't want to have a king for." So how could Shmuel, what's the issue there? How does Shmuel get presented in a totally negative way? So Rav Nevensal explains that, yes, it's true, a king could have the perspective of doing these things, and a king is given that power, and a king has the ability to abuse their power. But at the essence, what is the perspective of a king? A king, the main point of a king is that he should be a letuelas am, that's for the benefit of the nation. And the king is a giver. The king is a nosein. The king is somebody who is attempting to help out all the people. And everything mentioned over the course of this parsha is really for the toelos of the people. And in fact, the last thing mentioned in that parsha is that the king has to write his own Sefer Torah. Why should he write his own Sefer Torah? To remember that everything is not for me, rather everything is for the service of a Kodesh Baruch Hu and the service of the Jewish people and all of the positive qualities that service of Hashem entails, which means a service for the Jewish people. There is a what? Right, you carry around with him to always remind him of that idea. Well, it's supposedly very little. I mean, right. You see pictures, not photographs, but pictures on around the arm that it was like something that he wore on his arm. I'm not sure what exactly it was, but it did contain the whole the Torah. Yeah. Well, he had to write the first copy that everybody's obligated to do. Right, so for that he could participate in the Kol Torah project or something, but he needed his own personal Sefer Torah that he would keep with him at all times. I'm not sure he would. I don't know what the laws are. If he had to write it or something, I don't remember the details of it. But there is, just to give the clarity of what a king is supposed to do. So I find much consolation in this Gemara as a rabbi. A couple of weeks before Pesach. So somebody in the shul who has a dog wrote to me that apparently the kashrus agencies this year before Pesach stopped advertising which dog food is okay. They stopped listing brands of dog food good for Pesach. Rather, they gave guidelines as to what to look for in the ingredients. So these are three brands. These are three brands. If you don't mind looking through the ingredient list just to double check that everything's okay, I'd appreciate it. And then they add in a line, "I'm sure you didn't go learn in Smicha for 10 years in order to start looking through dog food ingredients. But, you know, sorry, that's the deal." So it's okay. That's all right. I made the same ha'ara when we were trekking through the forest attempting to get that Erev up a couple of weeks ago while slipping over the trees over there. And also, this Gemara came into mind. Yes, the poison ivy that follows us where. V'idach, that there's an interpretation of a pasuk, L'David, that David HaMelech said in Tehillim, Shamra nafshi ki chasid ani, guard my soul, for a devout man am I. So what does he mean by that? So another, one interpretation is, Kach Amar David Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem said to David, Rabbono Sholem, Lo Chaserani, aren't I, am I not devout? Shekol Malchim Mizrach Umarav Yoshum Agudus Agudus Bichvodam. That for all other kings of the East and West, they sit amongst their own company in their own glory. I mean, they just sit around and enjoy the fact that they're famous. But as for me, my hands are filled with blood, embryos, and afterbirths. I mean, I'm the one who's brought all the women bring their bedika cloths to me. The woman, I have to look through to figure out which women are permitted to their husband. Right? Kedei latar isha labayla, in order to be the one who permits a woman to her husband.
Wow.
That's what David HaMelech said. I paskin to all the shailas. No. Kohen looks at the skins and things like that. But with regards to a woman who's nida, right? A woman, whether she could be permitted to her husband or not. So that's done. I mean, nowadays it's done by the rabbi, right? But David HaMelech was the Gadol Hador. So he's the one who paskined all of these shilas. And then he goes on, V'lo od el komashani osani nimlapim Mephibosheth rabbi. And not only that, but everything I do, I consult with Mephibosheth my rabbi. So this image of David HaMelech, and David HaMelech, I mean, he was a baal tzedakah, he was the one who controlled all the tzedakah funds for the Jewish people. He was involved in all of these different things. So you see the role that the king is supposed to play, not as a king who absorbs power for himself, but rather a king that is a nosein, a king that is a giver. There is a story on this note of a king. I heard a couple, there's a famous story of Aaron of Karlin, that the story goes he was the Baal Shachris in his shul for Shachris on Yom Narayim. So the first day of Rosh Hashanah, he gets up to become the Chazan. Ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha Okay. That story's in the Chabad Siddur?
So.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, the story has gotten around. It happened in shul? It happened. Oh, you know, I told you that story. Yes, I once fainted as chazan. That was at the end of Shacharis, and that was because I had the flu. But so they woke him up, and they said, when he came to, they asked him what happened. So he said, because when I said Hamelech, so I imagined myself in front of the king, and then my mind drifted to the Gemara in Gittin, where Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai goes in front of Vespasian, and Vespasian, and he says, and he greets Vespasian as the king, and Vespasian wasn't the king yet, or he didn't realize he was the king yet.
No,
so Vespasian, he didn't know yet he was. Right. So Vespasian says to him, you're Chayav Nisa twice. One is because you called me the king and I'm not the king. And if I really am the king...
Why didn't you put down the rebellion?
No.
Why did you come in front of me?
If I am the king, what took you so long?
I thought it was...
What took you so long to get here? Right. So that's the... I had that image. I was in front of myself in front of the king. And I was told... What took you so long to get here? And that is an image of a king that's scary, right? That's an approach to melech that is, we're afraid to stand in front of the king. But if one also recognizes the king, not like a David HaMelech king, like the Torah perspective of a king, that a king is not just one that instills fear, which is necessary,
right.
But it's L'tova Sa'am, but the king is also a giver. So if we recognize the king as a giver, so then we have the guts, we have the wherewithal to stand in front of the king appropriately. And we realize that even the things that the king gets, I mean, according to the Torah, the king gets things. The king actually has more wives and more horses and more money than anybody else. And the king does demand more respect than anyone else. And the king has more power than anyone else. But we ultimately realize that even those... that kingship, that power that he has, and that wealth that he has, that's also a tovasan. That's also for the benefit. It's also for the benefit of the. It's also for the benefit of the people. Two more notes, or should we, or call it a day? Keep going. Bruce says keep going. So one more note is there is a Perek in Pirkei Avos, so it makes the there's a mission in Pirkei Avos where it discusses Ezuhu Gibor Hakovish Es Yitzro Ezuhu Chacham Halomin Mikol Adam, and one of the things mentioned there is Ezuhu Mechubad Hanosin Kavod Lachem, who is the one who is honored, one who gives honors to other one, one who honors other ones. So there is a sefer that's from the Stipler. Actually, excuse me, from Chaim Kanievsky, Archos, I forget the name right now. So he makes a very important ara on this Mishnah, where he says that all of those things are counterintuitive. Meaning, ezuhu ashir hasameach b'chalka, who is wealthy, one who can is happy with their lot. Usually, I would have thought, who is wealthy, one who could buy whatever they want. He says, no, one who is wealthy, but that's never ending. So one who is wealthy, one who actually is happy with what they have, right? And it's who is one, somebody who is wise, somebody who learns from others. I would have thought somebody who is wise is somebody who doesn't need to learn from others. So therefore, we learn that no, it's one who learns from other people. And therefore, who is the one who is honored? One who gives honor to others. Because if you don't give honor to others, if you don't recognize the value of other people, so any kavod that they give you back is going to be meaningless. Because they're giving me honor, they're nothing. So you have to imbue others with honor in order for a person to actually. For a person to be honored. So perhaps that also, by the way, of a king, that a king has to recognize the importance, the power of his subjects in order to truly be a true king. And then I heard this story yesterday.
So
I think
who is powerful.
Right, same thing. Who is powerful? One who is kovishes yitzro. I would have thought, who is powerful? One who can destroy whatever they want, that can do whatever they want. The answer is no. Who is powerful? One who actually can control themselves. Right?
That's
the same. It's the same concept. All four. There's four examples in that Mishnah. They all fit along the same lines.
Right.
That's all counterintuitive, but they all make sense.
In the spirit,
hold the other
person.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That's like what you're saying.
All right. Hod Shavahod, seeing the other person. Okay? So we should have said this yesterday. Maybe we should have skipped Halakha then. So one more story that I heard from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, I was listening to yesterday. There, I came across this website, Torah Downloads, which has all, why a Torah has 120,000 shiurim on it, and Torah Downloads has another 40,000 shiurim on it or so if you want to listen to them. So it has a lot of shiurim. It was put together, my nephew actually was involved in putting it together in Silver Spring, so it has a lot of shiurim from the Rabbanim over there. So Rav Heinemann has a lot of shiurim on it, and Rav Reidowitz and Rav Lopiansky. So Rav Lopiansky I've gotten into it since he came to the Kollel in Hanukkah time, so I listened to a few of his shiurim. So I was listening to a shiur yesterday that he gave about the stories of Rav Yisrael Salanter. And one of the stories that he mentioned was that Rav Yisrael Salanter was in Eastern Europe, and he was asked this is the time when the Haskalah was raging, the Enlightenment, and he was asked by the Russian government and by the Haskalah people to start a new yeshiva that would also work with secular knowledge.
Right.
Like, you would put together a college/yeshiva, and this would solve all the world's problems, at least solve all the Jewish problems. So Yisrael Salanter turned him down. He said no. And that actually was the end of him in Eastern Europe. He left Eastern Europe after that. You can't. And he went to Germany, and then went to France for a while, and ended up back in Germany. But Yisrael Salanter was asked, so why not? Why didn't you do it? So he said, I don't know. I don't know why this is, but I'll tell you the following. When a poor person knocks on the door of the rabbi and has a shaila, the rabbi usually runs to take care of that shaila, because it usually has a big impact. Right? He has those days, the shaila that the rav got the most often is the shaila that I get the least often, that is trefos. Right, that they would come with the lungs, they would come with the chicken, and they would ask the rabbi, is this chicken kosher, is lung kosher? So the rabbi immediately takes care of it and works very hard on it, because he knows that if he doesn't paskin it appropriately, not appropriately isn't the right way of saying it, but if he's just machmir, he just casts it aside, so that's a loss of a lot of money. That's a big loss for these people. So he works very hard on those shilas. While on the rich person, the wealthy person comes, the wealthy person sometimes will shrug his shoulders and say, listen, it's better to be machmir. No, it's not going to be that big of a loss for you.
Right.
So a rav who comes out of yeshiva, so that's his approach. As opposed to a doctor, the doctor takes a lot more care of the wealthy person than he does of the not well. He's not talking about a tzaddik doctor. He's just talking in general, a guy who goes through all of his years of medical school and then he's a doctor. So who does he care more for, the rich patient or the poor patient? He cares for the rich patient more than the poor patient. So he says, I don't know what it is. I don't know why that is, but somehow that's the case. So I don't want Torah shouldn't be taught in a university. Torah should be taught in a yeshiva, and that's why he turned him down. So perhaps it's the same that the king, it has to be the king, the rav, the person who is the authority figure. They have to recognize themselves as a nosim. They have to recognize themselves that they're in a position not to be one who receives, but rather one specifically who is a giver. That note, have a good Shabbos. Stop here. Yes.